Ja. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the public dissertation defense of Hilda Deborah, entitled Towards Spectral Mathematical Morphology. My name is Nils Galstad Svensson. I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Computer Science and Media Technology here at NTNU in Gjøvik, and I'll conduct this defense. The thesis has been submitted in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree of PhD in Computer Science at the Faculty of Computer Science and Media Technology. Hilda Deborah has carried out her doctoral training in cooperation with the University of Poitiers under a co-tutelle agreement. At 10:15 today, Hilda presented her doctoral trial lecture, and before the public dissertation defense can take place, the evaluation committee needs to take the decision regarding the approval of the trial lecture. So I'd like to ask the administrator of the committee about if the committee found the trial lecture satisfactory. Thank you very much, and congratulations, Hilda.
Thank you.
Then I'll give a short presentation of Hilda. She obtained her bachelor's degree in computer science from the University of Indonesia in 2010. During her bachelor's study, she worked as part-time as a teaching assistant and lab tutor for various courses in mathematics and software engineering. After graduation, she worked for a year in pattern recognition and image processing laboratory at the same university. She then joined the Erasmus Mundus master's program CIMET, Color in Informatics and Media Technology, in 2011 and graduated in 2013. Her study in CIMET was conducted at University Jean Monnet in France, University of Granada in Spain, and Gjøvik University College. She then started her PhD shortly after obtaining the master's degree. The evaluation committee and its administrator are the following. The first external opponent is Professor Jocelyn Chanusson from Grenoble Institute of Technology, France. Welcome. The second external opponent is Associate Professor Robert Jensen from University of Tromsø, the Arctic University of Norway. Welcome. And the internal opponent and administrator of the committee is Professor Katrin Franke from the Faculty of Computer Science and Media Technology at NTNU in Gjøvik. Welcome, Katrin. Questions ex auditorium must be notified to me as the chairman of the defense during the break between the first and the second opposition. Such contributions should be well prepared, precisely formulated, and submitted within a time frame of no longer than 10 minutes. I'll also remind you about this before the break. Finally, I would like to inform you that the proceedings are being streamed and recorded, and I would also like to remind you to mute your electronic devices now. On that, I'll leave the floor to you, Deborah. Hilda.
Okay, so I guess I'm just going to start. I'm presenting you my PhD work, which has been carried out for roughly 3 years, and the title of my PhD is Towards Spectral Mathematical Morphology. This has been conducted in both Color Lab here in NTNU Gjøvik and XLIMSIC laboratory at the University of Poitiers in France. So within the co-tutelle arrangement, I spent some time here and then also in France. My supervisors are Noël Richard from University of Poitiers, Jon Yngve from here, NTNU Gjøvik, and Kristen Fernandez from University of Poitiers. So going to the motivation. Here I show you a subset, a tiny, tiny subset of the Scream painting. So if we look at this subset of the painting and then we just ask ourselves how many white pigments are there in this subset. So with what we see is that, okay, maybe there's one, this white pigment, or maybe that's the same as this, or maybe there are two or three. We don't know. But the issue with conservation in for cultural heritage objects is that it requires precise identification and decision. So in this regard, traditional color imaging, what I show you here, is not reliable. And then just relying on our eyes, how many white pigments are there, it's really not reliable, and we are not supposed to do conservation of these objects with this means. So hyperspectral imaging can provide an alternative in a way. So here I show you four spectral functions, or I will just say four spectra shortly, taken from different regions which to my eye looks like white. And from this figure, we know that there are possibly several whites in there in the painting. Now, previously with traditional color imaging, just with our eyes, we don't know. With hyperspectral imaging, we are allowed to, quote, see much more. It's also because the hyperspectral imaging provides measurement of optical and physical properties of the materials. So it gives high accuracy, not only in terms of the spectral resolutions, but also the spatial resolution. This is really just a tiny part of the screen painting. So, yes, great. We can do hyperspectral imaging on these paintings, and then ideally we want to do the subsequent process again with this high accuracy that's offered and whatnot. But the problem generally is that the size of a hyperspectral image is really a burden. For example, we have a hyperspectral capture of the screen painting, and the size of that, just that one image, was around 25 gigabytes. So how do you deal with that? The common strategies that people use to deal with such big amount of data, such big size of image, is that they do either dimensionality reduction or band selection first, so that we have, after a pre-processing, we have a reduced size, and then we can process them in a less time. But then doing this, it's actually a compromise on the gain of accuracy that's offered by the imaging, because doing dimensional reduction and band selection during the process, we're not only removing the noise that's usually typically assumed, but we are only removing we are also removing the variations in there. So in this way, we lost the accuracy, which was the reason why we do hyperspectral imaging in the first place. So with this consideration, we said alternatively we can process the images metrologically, aiming to maintain the accuracy that's offered by the imaging technology. So the research objective, based on those considerations and motivations, is to develop a metrological image processing and analysis framework for hyperspectral data. This has been carried out with a full band approach through mathematical morphology framework, and then with metrology, we will be able to avoid non-robust, non-reproducible, and inaccurate results. But this means, imposing metrology means that we have to validate the process at each level of the processing chain. Here's a little graph, which I will come again into later, of how the validation should, let's say, be applied into the image processing. So we have the theoretical world, and then we have a case where it's closer to the real world, and then as close as to the theoretical world, we will have metrological evaluation with theoretical images that we create. And then as we go closer to the real world, we'll probably have some ground truth or reference until we don't have reference at all. Another objective is also that the developed framework will be applied to cultural heritage field, but this doesn't restrict the genericity of the approach to other fields as well. Just to shortly tell you, from this 3 years of work, we have been able to publish 6 articles, one in a journal, and 5 to conferences. Here are the list. So the presentation will be organized in 3 parts. Here I have the image processing framework, let's say. I will divide them into 2 parts. First is the analysis of just spectral content. The second part will be analysis and processing of spectral and spatial content. Here are some numbers which relate to the manuscript, if you have it. And then I will give briefly later in the third part the metrology and quality assessment of that we did in different parts of this developed framework. So let's go into the first part, which is the analysis of spectral content. Here's yet another subset of the screen painting. So if I just compute the color gamut of this image, I have this one blob, one gamut, despite what my eyes see, that, okay, there are blues, I don't know how many, there are whites, reds, and yellow or brown. But with the color gamut, we probably see some distribution of red and so on, but they are in one blob, and it's really difficult to discriminate what we see with our eyes. On the other hand, if I just take randomly from this subset some spectra, this is what I get. I see that we know that there are differences in here, that the spectra are discriminable. What if I increase the number of random spectra I take significantly? It becomes difficult to differentiate, but we know there are some diversity in there. There are variations. We know that they're there, but with this way, it's difficult to see. So now the issue is, how do we represent spectral diversity, spectral variation that exists in this image? So this is the same subset as before, and I took 4 spectra from this approximate region, sort of to represent the white, blue, red, and then the yellow, brown. And this is what the spectral look like. So just looking at this spectra right away, there are 2 elements of interest. First is the intensity difference. And then second is the shape. For example, this cyan one is going this way. And then for the yellow one, it's a little bit like a sigmoid function. So again, there are 2 elements of interest that we want to quantify, which is the shape and intensity differences. And we want to be able to quantify this, and the direction is through or by means of spectral differences. Now, the hypothesis is that spectral difference function should be a measure. But first, here I want to, let's say, clarify. By the term difference, we mean distance and similarity, both of them. So they have strictly speaking, they have their theoretical requirements to satisfy. But since at the beginning I mentioned that we stress on the notion of metrology, in addition to imposing the theoretical requirements, we say it's not enough, we have to treat the difference functions as measure, and that means that they are to be metrologically assessed. Here's one additional constraint that we imposed, which is monotonicity. So D is a distance function, S is one spectra, G S theta is basically a modification on S. So what we want to see in these different distance functions is that the distance between a spectrum and its modified version should be proportional to the modification we give to the original spectrum. There are various mathematical expressions of what is the difference. Or basically, there are tons of different distance similarity functions out there. And they all assume different things, but also because they were made for different purposes as well. Now, if we are to use them for spectral data, we have to go back into what they were made for to sort of to see the underlying assumptions, because it's not always correct for spectral data. Here's one example. If, for example, like just using Euclidean distance, the underlying assumption is that the spectral bands are not correlated, which is not true, because we know that in the hyperspectral data, we know that the bands are correlated. So this is like an example of what assumptions are not true. And then we will also have to then evaluate and validate all these different kinds of distance functions before to use them. Just some remarks. Spectral differences are scalar values. Yes, we are reducing the high information from, let's say, 250 bands into one values, but nevertheless, it's still a characterization, and we can increase the number of information we want by decomposing the different the distance function we have into several parts. And just to briefly say that difference functions are the core, or distance functions are the core of many, many things: BCA, classification, nonlinear filtering, and here the focus of my study is mathematical morphology. So now we're going into a little bit more detail into spectral difference functions. After defining the constraint and then what we want to see in a distance function, we have to first see what are out there, and then we apply the constraints that we have, the criteria what we have, into these different functions. And here is the taxonomy which we made for these various distance functions based on their underlying definition of what a spectral function, or what is a spectrum, basically. So, for example, the Minkowski-based function, Chebyshev, Euclidean, Manhattan, they assume a spectrum as a vector in the Euclidean space, and so on. So here's the categorization of the different distance functions, and it has been, for the taxonomy 1 to 4, it has been published in a journal article. So if you want to read more, you can read in the manuscript or in the article, but basically the answer for a more suitable spectral difference function does not come from these three first categories. So our option now is left with the difference functions which consider a spectrum as a probability density function, or a cumulative distribution function, or those distance functions that consider a spectrum as a series. So with the first group that we're considering, is that those group that consider a spectrum as a distribution function. here are the examples of what are the functions in there, in this group. Spectral correlation, which is widely used in remote sensing, F-divergences, chi-square statistics, and so on. Now let's take the assumptions. The assumption for this group is that a spectrum has the spectral bands of the spectrum are ordered. So the 360 nanometer should come before the 460 nanometer, and so on. So this is correct. But also the second assumption is that a spectral function is either a PDF, a CDF, or a histogram. The limitation comes from those functions who consider a spectrum as a PDF because the integral of a PDF must be equal to 1, and it's not applicable for radiance and reflectance data. Nevertheless, here's our first proposition. It's called Euclidean distance of a cumulative spectrum. So we developed this trying to overcome the behavior of the different distance functions, it could be read more in the manuscript, which was not desirable, which is called the saturation problem. It measures both shape and intensity differences, what we said before as the interest point of what we want to quantify. And here's the equation. The limitation is just that the measure of shape and intensity are merged, so we get one number and there's no possibility of having a b-dimensional representation, which I will come into later. Here's the second option for the group of distance functions, which consider a spectrum as a series or a function. The assumption is spectral bands are ordered, the same as before, it's correct, but the sum of spectral values doesn't have to be 1. So spectral Kolbeck-Leibler pseudo-divergence, or shortly KLPD, is the last proposition developed by colleagues in XLIMSIC laboratory. So here's the function. It has independent shape measure and intensity measure. So currently this is the most suitable spectral difference function, and this is the function that we will use throughout the rest of the presentation. So now we come into the second part of the first big part of the presentation, which is histogram of spectral differences. Here's this image again. We can ask ourselves how many pigments or colors are present. And here's a graphical representation of the variation that we see in here. And this was made possible by making a histogram for both measures of shape and intensity and then plot them. So this was given by the KLPD, the parts of the KLPD, the shape and then intensity. So here we can say roughly we have blue, white, red, and yellow. And here we can also say we have roughly 4 groups. Sorry. And here's the b-dimensional histogram of spectral differences. I will probably continue referring it with BHSD. This is something that I annotated manually, and then I took randomly from each of these blobs and then extract one spectrum from each of the manually annotated group, and then this is like how they look like. So this is just to show that the groups that are forming here actually make sense, that it's not just taking that it's not just that the same things are not scattered around in different blobs. Just to give a brief comparison, so this is what we saw before with the KLPD measure. this is with other measure. So spectral angle is also a measure of shape. Euclidean distance is a measure of intensity. So if we use them, this is what we get. So from here we can see that there is a reduction of discrimination of the content that we have here. Partly also because spectral angle and Euclidean distance are actually correlated. Now, I've shown the b-dimensional representation. Should we stop in the b-dimensional representation for discriminating the content of an image? No. We can actually increase the histogram. Now here I give you an example of a three-dimensional histogram. So you can obtain one histogram by using a reference. One reference, because you have a distance. Distance to what? So you need a reference. You can obtain two histograms by using two references. So here is an example. Here are two BHSDs. So if we combine the values we get from these two BHSDs, basically in a way saying that we combine histograms computed from two different references, we can have this one. So this is a three-dimensional representation of the diversity that we have in here. Now we only see one big blob. But in order to see the main groups inside, we're going to see, let's say this is the threshold, and we're going to move the threshold so as to remove those things that are with less counts. Now we have kind of two. This was manually annotated. From this one, which is previously one, if we increase the threshold for the pixel count, we have two more, so now we have three. If we increase again, then this was the one that was previously shown, but now because we increased, then it's gone. We have three in the previously big one. So in total, we have five groups in this one subset of the painting. But so until now, I only tell you we can use different references, and we can have this different representation. We can discriminate the content using a distance function and then the reference. But how do we actually select the right references so that our discrimination are optimal? So now is the last point of the first part. So this is to show you that how significant choosing a reference can mean to the discrimination of our content. Here's an image with roughly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 groups of colors. Here's a b-dimensional histogram using one reference. Here's another histogram using another reference. So you can see that there is a significant difference in the discrimination of the content in this graphical representation because of the selection of the reference, not because of the distance. So how to actually select the references? Here we consider the spectral content of an image as a convex hull. So the constraints are a good reference is not too far. This is the illustration in a two-dimensional space. This is the convex hull of the spectral content. So a good reference is not too far from the convex hull, because if it's too far, then we will have one distribution for the content, and we don't know which one comes from A, B, or C groups. It should also not be picked from inside the dataset. Any of the pixels from your image, basically, because when we do that, then let's say this is the illustration. This is one part of our data, and then we take a reference from here. This is what happens. It will be able to, let's say, recognize the group it was from, but there's a risk of these two groups being merged, and this is an illustration of how the distribution would look like. It should also not be located in from inside the convex hull, even though it's not necessarily from the initial data set, because we will still have this risk. So what should we do then? Rather than all those things that we shouldn't do, we should pick the reference from approximately at the periphery, just outside a little bit of the convex hull. And then, yes, we still have the risk of mixing two groups together, but then it's reduced. So that was the concept. How does it work in reality? How do we have this convex hull and so on? Here I illustrate it with this one image. And then I have five spectra taken from inside the image. I have two simulated spectra that I just made. So the two are artificial. So now if I use P red, which was one of the things that came from inside this, and here how it was illustrated in the concept before, this is what I get as the bidimensional representation. So despite my eye seeing that there are blue, white, red, and yellow, here I see something but not very clear. What if I use one of the artificial spectrum as the reference? Here's an example that was not shown in the concept before, but it's something that's approximately at the periphery, is that, yes, I have better discrimination of the content, but can we actually improve this? So as we go further from the convex hull, but still close enough, this is our one as the reference, then we have much better discrimination. Here, roughly, we have this 1, 2, 3, this little one here, 4, and 5 groups of pigments that the histogram says are in the image. This is, let's say, another representation of how the histogram can help in selecting the reference. So instead of, for every point, instead of a histogram count, this was made, the color was the actual color in the color image. So let's say we have picked this one reference, and then it helps in telling, okay, my reference was this one, the R1 was of a lighter color, and then if I pick something from here, then it will be of a darker color. So this is another representation which would help in discrimination of pigments and so on. But note that this is not a chromaticity diagram, that this each of these points are plotted there, and so there it's in a three-dimensional space, it's like there are a lot of other colors behind the blues that we see in here. So to conclude or to finish the first part, we have seen difference functions which are at the core of metrological image processing. I've also shown the first proposal, Euclidean distance of cumulative spectrum, and then a more recent and suitable one for a spectral distance function was studied, which is KLPD, where it was concluded as the more suitable one, mostly because of its independent parts of shape and intensity, which has been allowing us to do these graphical representations. We have also a new analysis tool, which is bidimensional histogram of spectral differences, which was given us, where the computation was made based on the two parts of KLPD, the shape and intensity components. It's an easy to understand tool, especially with modified sorry, with the modified PSHD, because in that space you can know, okay, which color should I have for my reference? Is it lighter? Is it darker? And so on. And then it could be a new way to consider spectral classification. So far, I've only shown you the two-dimensional and three-dimensional, but this is easily extendable to the n-dimensional space by using more reference. Now we go to the second part of the presentation, which is the processing of spectral and spatial content. So here's a little motivation. So In image processing, we can categorize the approach as linear and nonlinear approaches. The problem with the linear approach is that to date there's no valid addition and multiplication with a scalar for spectrum, and so linear approach is not suitable for the metrological image processing framework. So in the coming slides, we will go into the nonlinear approach where we only need an ordering relation. Here's an overview of the framework. So basically, from ordering relation, we can have this full framework. But yeah, the problem is that we have to have the ordering relation. If we don't have it, then all these things are not enabled, basically. These existing ordering approaches, there are this independent or reduced Bayesian approaches, marginal ordering relation. It's basically you order a multivariate values independently at each of the channels. So if you have two color information, you will consider the order based separately on the red, green, and so on. And then there are the full band approaches, which is the lexicographic bit mixing and so on. Here's a little bit more on the existing approaches. So as I've told you before, the marginal ordering relation works like this. So we have these two cases of spectra, let's say. What we want to know from these two cases is that, okay, give me which one is the minimum, which one is the maximum. For the marginal approach, the first group was okay because the marginal approach works in a way that if a spectrum is larger than the other, then it has to be larger in all of the bands. So in this case, it's okay because the red one in all the bands, it's larger than the yellow one. In this one, it was not okay. If we recall, this was the original set. So until approximately 600, red is lower, is smaller than the purple. And then from approximately 600 ahead, it's on the other, it's the other way. So in this case, the marginal approach cannot, let's say, cannot decide which one is bigger or not or smaller. So because it cannot decide, then it does this. It takes the maximum independently at each bands. So what you have in the end is a false color or a new color. Lexicographic ordering relation is another approach. So with the marginal, it considers separately the bands. In here, it's it considers separately also, but in a conditional manner. So, for example, we have this one set. We want to know the minimum and maximum. If we just say this intensity-wise, the purple is the minimum, this one is the maximum. But what the lexicographic ordering relation returns us is actually this one that was on the top. In most cases are the minimum, and this one is the maximum. It was because it works conditionally, so if it finds decision at the first wavelength, here, the purple at the 450, it's bigger than the red, so it says, okay, purple is bigger than the red, and it doesn't consider the rest of the information. here's the our proposed ordering relation. It's called conditional ratio and angular distance based ordering relation. The concept is basically this. So we will need two reference points, and then we will compute the distance of this. Let's say we have this two S1 and S2 to the reference points. The idea is that this with the ratio of distance, so the ratio of distance from S1 to this and from S1 to this other reference. But as we know, with ratio, we can have ratio of 4 and 2, ratio of 2 and 1 are the same. So how do we tackle that problem? Here's just an illustration. With just doing the ratio, S1 and S2 will be determined as the same. So we need another information, which here is something that is proportional to angle information, because even though these two have the same ratio, they will have different angle. So I've talked for some time about ordering relation, but what is really the impact of it? How is it important? Is it important? Is it not? So here is the impact of ordering relation in the results of spectral median filtering. So median filter, when we do a median filter to an image, you expect a smoothing effect, but with the edge still intact, let's say. Here is the original image, and then with different ordering relations, we can build different spectral median filtering, and here are the impacts. So with the lexicographic ordering as the core of the spectral median filter, we don't get the smoothing effect. What we get instead is actually these grainy artifacts. With bit mixing, it performs better, but we still have these little problems around here. Here's just a zoom of the previous image, so you can see better how the impact works on the details. So if we use other ordering relations, which is the marginal, the cumulative distance, and then the proposed approach, what do we see? With the marginal, it looks really nice. It has the smoothing effect, and then the edge is preserved really nicely. With the cumulative distance approach, which is the state of the art for for multivariate median filter, we see the smoothing, but it's more blurry, let's say. With the proposed ordering relation, we see also the smoothing, but we still have these problems in here. If we zoom a little closer, this is what the marginal ordering relation gives us. Looks nice. This is the benchmark or the state-of-the-art method. It's blurrier at the edge, but still has the smoothing effect. This is the proposed approach, which works well at the edge, but it has some problems on the details. Now, this, despite looking really nice, it's actually false colors. So what we see here is a color rendering of the spectra, but the spectra are actually, let's say, false spectra in a sense that they are spectra that didn't exist before. With the state-of-the-art method, it's blurrier mainly because it assumes unimodal distribution at each kernel that it's the filter is passing through, and it's rarely satisfied in real case. Now, for the proposed method, because it's based on a distance, we don't have an assumption of the data distribution. It has, compared to the benchmark, it has better preservation of the edge, but there are still problems that needs to be worked on for the details. Here's another example of the impact of ordering relation in morphological dilation. Here's the original image, dilated with marginal ordering relation as the core, related with the proposed ordering relation as the core. Here the note is that, yeah, maybe the two look nice and whatnot, but again, marginal ordering relation suffers from false color. Here, there are some purple, if you can see in the screen, which doesn't exist in the initial image. And then if I zoom to that part, it's here. So this purple part, which does not exist in the initial image, is obtained because it mixing some parts from this blue dot in here and then from the brown part. And finally, we have this false color. And then with the proposed approach, these are colors that initially exist in the original image. In the b-dimensional representation, which is slightly modified, how does the false color look like? So this white circles are the original values of the image. So if I plot the colors, the spectra that I get after the deletion, it should be located inside the circles. And as we can see with the deletion, it's always outside the initial data set. After enabling spectral ordering relation, after having spectral ordering relation, we can enable the framework. One of this is the morphological image segmentation. If we have a look back on the general framework I've shown before, it's taking this direction. Basically, with our proposed distance-based ordering relation, we can compute erosion, deletion, and so on, and then in the end, it leads us to a segmentation. So the morphological segmentation is based on this notion of morphological gradient. How do we compute that? It's a subtraction between the deleted and eroded image. This is in the grayscale. How do we extend that to the spectral domain? It's by using a distance function replacing this subtraction. And since we use this KLBD function, which previously I've said is decomposable into shape and intensity measures, we can have the gradient that we have here, that's initially just an extension, as something that's decomposable into shape and intensity. Here's an example of the original image, and this is the spectral gradient image. Okay. And with this different decompositions, you have different information, basically, because it also captures different information. And based on those different gradients, these are the segment preliminary results of segmentation. Of course, they give different results. Crack detection of cultural heritage painting. This old paintings, they suffer from cracks, and it's apparent, it's everywhere, even though with our bare eyes we don't see it, but it's everywhere, in mostly in old paintings. The existing approaches, they define cracks as having elongated structure and low luminance values. But there are also colored cracks, so the cracks are not always black. In this case, it's yellow. So instead of using the state-of-the-art method, which is grayscale top hat transform, we use the our framework in the spectral full band approach, and it works by subtracting opening and closing image. This is just shortly how it's extended, and here are some results from the crack detection. So. Just to give a discussion, I have presented the ordering relation, which is the core of the mathematical morphology framework, and also I have based on that we can enable several process, and I have shown preliminary results for gradient based watershed morphological segmentation. And also I have shown briefly an application to cultural heritage domain and the problem of detecting cracks in a painting. Shortly on the metrological assessment, So this is something I've shown before. We have insisted that we want metrological image processing tool, but so far we didn't say anything about the metrological evaluation. So I'm going to show you two of the evaluations we did. First is the assessment of uncertainty, which take place in here. So we use theoretical images to assess spectral distance function. Here's the example. So the aim is to measure the ability of distance or similarity functions to assess variations. You have this theoretical spectra. You take the middle as the reference and how the distance functions would react to that. Ideally, you would see, because the reference is always in the middle, ideally you would see something that's monotonically increasing, but it's not always the case. Another is assessment of accuracy using image with ground truth or reference. We did this with to assess spectral ordering relations. So what we did was, we have this image, we did spectral median filtering on that, and we assessed the edge, because ideally in spectral median median filtering, you want the edge to be preserved. Remarks for metrological assessment: it's required by industrial, medical, other application fields, and so on. Because there is this need to justify the gain of accuracy, which is the reason why we want to do hyperspectral imaging. Because also hyperspectral imaging is not just a click of a button. As a conclusion, the research objectives has been to develop a metrological spectral image processing framework applied specifically to cultural heritage domain. And the key contributions has been nonlinear image processing tools, or specifically rank order filters and mathematical morphology, with distance function and ordering relation as the core of the framework. And then in addition to those, we also have a set of metrological assessment protocols for the various spectral image processing tools. If we look at the framework, let's say this is one way to look at the framework. The green parts are the operators or tools that I have developed. And so for a future work, as a perspective, we can further enable all these different tools in the framework. But that also comes with, because it's not right away. So there are theoretical properties and metrological assessment to develop. And there are also works at the more theoretical level for spectral difference function, ordering relation, and so on. That's it. Thank you for your attention. No, not yet. Okay. I think it's not turned on.
So all electronic devices were actually muted. So that's so. Thank you, Niels, for the introduction. I'd like to start by thanking Professor Jan Hardeberg for the invitation to come here, join this committee. It's a real pleasure and real honor for me to be back in Jøvik. And actually, this brings me back to 34 years ago in 82. I visited Oppland and Lake Mjøsa and all these surroundings on my way to the North Cape with the family. But we are not here to talk about myself and my experience in Norway. We are here to talk about you, Deborah. And I would like to thank you. Thank you for your excellent presentation. I greatly appreciate it. and thank you for your work. And also thank you for the way you are presenting your work in the report. So these are three different things. The work, the way you present it in the report, and the way you present it in your presentation. I think all three aspects are really outstanding. Okay, I already gave up my buzzword this morning for your trial lecture. I think this work is elegant. You know, I like when you read a scientific paper, scientific content, and you see everything flowing naturally, and it's just simply elegant. And it's elegant in nature, and again, in a more formal way, the way you present things, it's always very clear, very well structured, organized, and it really tells a lot about how well you master your topic. I think you cannot dissociate the form from the actual content. I enjoyed very much your report. I already mentioned this. I re-enjoyed the way you have these flow charts, always reminding the reader of where he is and where he's going to. So it's really helpful. And for each chapter, you have the conclusions, what we should remember from this chapter. And that's these guidelines are very useful, and I think it will make your report a very useful entry point into literature for the people following you. I also, of course, greatly appreciated you using the scream from Munch. You may not know it, but I used this picture in my own PhD back in the 90s.
Okay.
And actually, you know, we always say with the marginal ordering, we have a fake colors appearing.
Yeah.
But to be honest, just between you and me today, this is not so frequent. So, but with the scream, I could identify greenish color appearing where it's not supposed to be. So, I like the painting very much. And of course, we're in Norway, so that makes that makes sense. Okay, I would just make some comments, very minor comments. In your introduction, you say imaging spectroscopy started in remote sensing. I don't think this is true. So, we are lucky that we have no colleagues from the chemical department here today, but imaging spectroscopy has been used in chemistry for a long time, and maybe not imaging spectroscopy, maybe spectroscopy itself, right? I see Jean-Baptiste nodding, so, but okay, in spectroscopy, do you have issues that they were considering remote sensing afterwards, but it's really minor, so I won't ask you to venture to that, just a minor comment. In your report, sometimes you have a tendency to recall some common knowledge notions, like, okay, quantization and sampling, and what is the visual effect of both issues, and so on and so forth. We already had discussion this morning as well. It's nice because it's the basis for pedagogy, you know, recalls all the basics. For your PhD, I don't think that was always that relevant, but it's really, again, a minor issue. Okay, I will have some questions for you, don't worry. Yes. Okay, just random order. If you move back to your slide 28, that's the conclusion of your first part.
Conclusion of the first part? This one.
Yes. When you say easy to understand analysis tool, I kind of agree, but I wouldn't say this is an easy to use tool because you have this issue of your reference.
Yes.
So let's say I'm an end user. I have hyperspectral images because I work in the food industry, and it's critical for me to process this data very accurately. Mm. But I don't know nothing about mathematical morphology and image analysis.
Yeah.
So how can I use your tool? What would be your guidelines?
Yes, it's not so easy to construct probably for the reference. But the idea for having this reference is just that probably this in a future this should be better communicated and formulated. But the way I selected my reference is that, let's say I have, where there is an image. Let's say I have this image.
Yes.
So the idea for the reference is that, let's say you have a whole painting. You cannot have one global reference which works for every single one of your goal for this painting. So in a way, the experts, maybe from this field, he or she wants to know, okay, I want to know how many yellow are there in this painting. So that heuristic, let's say, is something that is guiding, that will be guiding her in selecting the reference, because I want to know the yellow, and then let's say this all are yellow, this one in the figure. So I in practice, how it works is that I have to construct my yellow reference or other reference that could tear apart, differentiate these different yellows. So here, from, let's say, in until the maybe 500 or 70, I see, okay, this one is a bit more characteristic, this one. So that's why from until this, I pick this characteristic from here, and then I put it in my reference. And then for the rest, I also always take something that's characteristic and then combine it into a new reference. So I think at this point, it is still probably difficult for just an expert that's from the other side of the field, from, let's say, cultural heritage or food industry or something, to, okay, I know what I want. I'm going to construct my reference. I'm going to have it. I think at this point it's still difficult because there are some knowledge that is still to be, you know, this expert needs to learn in how to construct the reference. But I think in the near future, this would be better formulated, and there's a way to make it automatically, in a way. Because now my heuristic is that, okay, from this part, which ones are the characteristics, from that part, which ones are the characteristics, and then I built my reference based on that. So I think it's not far from, you know, having an expert. I want this and this, and then a software, well, probably my software will do that. Yeah.
Okay. Two related questions still on this topic.
Yeah.
The whole process is not robust, but is respecting your initial assumption that you have to be monotonic with respect to the perturbation.
Yes.
So if I move the reference a little bit, then the result will only change a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Okay. If I change reference dramatically, I may have dramatically different results. That's okay. But at least you ensure that you have this continuity.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Very good. Have you considered, you know, this idea came being inspired by the stochastic watershed of Jesus Angulo. You may know this work. If we translate this into your problem, you could say, okay, let me pick up a bunch of references randomly selected, or randomly or guided, as following your guidelines that it should not be too far but not too close within. I like this kind of statement because it really gives an idea of how things will go.
Yeah.
So you could follow these rules and pick up a bunch of references, and then for each one do your process, go to the end, that is to say the classification, and then somehow aggregate all the results and say, okay, all the guys that are very often together, I will keep them together.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts?
So that's actually, let's say, the future work that I've been working on after submitting. So we have in this segmentation, which is really just using the watershed that's there, but feeding it with the spectral gradients. So the idea was that, okay, we have this spectral gradient that's, let's say, the total of the compositions, but then also depending on the content of the the image, it might be one or the other that are more relevant. And then in a lot of cases, like maybe like in one painting, you want to see a lot of different things. So actually the ongoing work is still, okay, we have this, let's say, three gradients that are different. How do we, let's say, combine it before feeding it into the watershed? Or maybe we do watershed on different things and then combine the results somehow after, something like that. So I think, I cannot really say much because I don't have the results yet. But it's also, let's say, one of the direction that, okay, we know there are different goals in, let's say, one painting, and we want to, let's say, well represented in one segmented image. Okay. Yeah.
Well, the question was also on the construction
on this. Yeah.
I'm not talking about watershed yet, but if you take like multiple references, you will get different
BHSD.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you can do the classification on those.
On those. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then so check how many times.
The colleagues in Poitiers, they've actually started doing classification work based on this. So now we just have two-dimensional, but it's easily extendable to...
Yes, you mentioned it.
Yes, so it's like you can have many more references, and then in the end it becomes your feature factor, and then you do classification on them. But in terms of comparing it with the stochastic, I don't know that work.
Okay. Yeah. If you move like to slide 39... So yes, on this example, the data, they are hyperspectral images, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, how many bands? I forgot.
This one was 160.
160.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to be clear, you just show color representations, but everything is done in the hyperspectral domain.
In the hyperspectral,
domain.
Yes.
Okay, very good. And then if you move to slide 46, that will take us to one of my questions from the report. So what?
And then so we have to do future works.
No, is it good or is it bad? And the second question, is it better than the others or not?
So it was let me tell like a little bit story of this, because always we do, okay, let's develop this tool, let's develop this operator, but then it's always like, yeah, okay, we have this developed, but then what's use? So the initial aim was actually to extend the gradient, and then how do we, because it's a little bit like median filter, it's difficult to, let's say, justify the development to, let's say, other public, because it's like a middle level, intermediate level of operator. So as a direct way to, let's say, is this gradient making any sense? Is it useful or not? Watershed is one step ahead. Let's put it in gradient-based watershed. So, and just looking at this image, we were like, that's encouraging. But really the work prior to the submission was encouraging. So that was, so we stopped at that, but since then, I've been working with the supervisors as well to, because also the challenge is, I look at this, it looks kind of okay, but how reliable is my okay, let's say. So we have been developing the test, how it works on theoretical images, on a slightly more complicated images and so on. So at this stage we are developing the criteria before to actually compare it with other approaches. Yes.
Okay. I understand. So I think the argument would be that your work is mostly like a theoretical contribution.
Yeah.
And then the experimental study is more like a proof of concept.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. In the scientific usual work, you know, there are always this stage where you say, oh, we have a problem, what's in the literature, and we see that the literature is good, but not always. So we identify bottlenecks or shortcomings, and then we make a proposal to overcome these shortcomings, and then we compare. So the comparison and the evaluation part is very, very difficult.
Yes.
You know, no question about that. You can do a qualitative evaluation. Say, well, it looks good. I think the borders looks fine, and the most objects are well separated. So you could do comparisons, and then you can do a quantitative assessment.
Yes,
and quantitative assessment of segmentation is very difficult. You can use synthetic images, but we all know the limitations.
Yeah.
You can do manual ground truth and then compute distances between the different segmentations, and I think you should do this in the next step. And also, this also applies for your crack detection part. You have some work in your thesis where synthetic images, when you compute some sort of score, so that's really good. But on the real images, it's more challenging. Okay. Okay, well, since we are talking about the crack detections now, so you are using a simple top hat, is that correct?
Yeah.
With a regular disc-shaped structuring
disc
elements?
Yeah, and then I just, let's say, 3-5 radius.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But doing so, you are missing one very important assumption on your problem, which is you said cracks are elongated objects.
Yeah.
So you are not using at all the fact that they are elongated. You're just using the fact that they are thin, but not that they are elongated. And in morphology, there are some tools. Do you know them?
So at the end of this crack detection study, we were actually, it's either alternating sequential filter or hit or miss.
Nope.
No? No. So the idea for us with those were basically also, because this is one scale, so if you want to, because the cracks are different scales, there are like the big ones, the white ones, the small ones, so we have to do several passes with different size of structuring element. So our idea was just, okay, let's do this in a multi-scale way.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, what I had in mind are the path operators, PATH operators.
Okay.
And they were proposed by Hugues Talbot some years ago.
Yeah.
And it's really powerful tool to detect exactly cracks. Even if you're very noisy, there are robust versions of it.
Okay.
But extending this to hyperspectral images could be a real challenge. But I really encourage you to look at this and see that this is
path
operators. Okay. It just looks for passes between pixels. So you don't even have to be strictly rectilinear.
Yeah.
It can be like curves. So that's really powerful. But it's computationally quite intensive, and so the extension to hyperspectral images could be very, very difficult.
Yeah.
But even taking a simple or just one band, then you could just apply it, and already you would very likely have competitive results compared to the one you have with top hats.
Yes. Okay.
That takes me to the next comment. You're testing only very basic morphological operations, erosion, dilations, and combinations, opening, closing, top hats. And that's, I don't know how to put it, maybe old-fashioned morphology, you know. And today the trend is no longer in these operators.
Yeah.
It's more like a graph-based processing. In the very high-dimensional space, like the hyperspectral images, the data, they are not filling the space randomly. You know, they are organized. And the feature space is almost empty, which is a good thing. And the data are organized in manifolds. They have a structure. And this structure has a much lower dimension than the hundreds you have. And then you can work in this subspace. and you can redefine all your morphological algorithms on these spaces. I don't know, have you read anything about this? Or
the manifold? No, it was only as far as the distance.
Yes.
Distance in the manifold space.
Okay.
So yeah.
But probably all your work could probably be moved fairly easily to these other representations.
Yeah.
I think so. I see a tremendous potential, actually.
Yeah. I don't know very well about that graph base or manifold morphology, but because also the main thing about this is it's based on distance, so we did careful consideration at the first phase. What distance is supposed to be used for spectra? So maybe in the manifold, then we have to do what is the distance for manifold space?
Well, you could use your distance, and that would probably be much better than the Euclidean distance.
Yeah. Okay. That's probably going to, I'm going to try. Yeah.
Okay. A small point on your page 156. That's about the vector median.
156. Yes.
Oh yes, so that's the one in the bottom. Okay, so you say yes, if you have two modes within your filtering window, and if you take the median, then it's going to be somehow in the middle of the two modes, which is known of the right answer in some way.
Yeah.
So that's a well-known limitation of the vector median. But you have ways in the literature to overcome this using a robust statistics. So you can use the alpha trim filter, where you just remove all the most extremes, the less extreme points. So it was just to moderate the statement a little bit that there are ways in the literature to overcome this problem. Okay, maybe a couple of more questions. In hyperspectral imaging, a very important issue is the issue of spectral mixtures. Within one pixel, you have different materials, and what you see is a mixture of the different end members, the pure materials. Are you familiar with this notion? Or
I did my master's thesis in an attempt, let's say, to do unmixing for painting. But then in there, the problem was not only optical mixing, but also there is probably chemical mixing. So what I did in there was trying to exhaustively, this different spectra, and then how many percent of that, and then exhaustively search which one, which mixture mimics closely the one I have from the painting. But the assumption in that linear mixing was not met, of course, for the painting case. Yeah.
So yes, I think if we talk about paintings, it's an interesting case of study, because you more or less know what you should, what you're looking for. So that this can, you could use a spectral library of the different pigments, for instance, that could help you drive the unmixing problem, because when we have mixtures, we want to do the unmixing, right? What you mentioned, so if you have like intrinsic mixtures, chemical mixtures,
yes,
probably means that the mixture you are observing are non-linear mixtures.
Yes.
Okay, that's bad.
Let's say in the linear it's multiplication, and then when the chemical mixture happens, it doesn't work that way.
Okay.
So the, let's say the confidence, if I remember correctly, the confidence was bad.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Because if you assume a linear mixture,
yeah,
then life is good because you have your, when you do your spectral differences,
yeah,
everything's linear. So you can probably write the equation of the mixture.
Yeah.
And then when you do the differences, it's as if you do the differences n member per n member.
Yeah.
You can rewrite the sum, summing it differently,
yes,
and then have each n member processed separately.
Yeah.
That I don't know where this would lead us, but that was nice and easy.
Yeah.
If the mixtures are nonlinear, it's more a challenge.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about this because I don't know if you know the work of Antonio Plaza. It's a work from 2002 or something. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first addressing mathematical morphology for hyperspectral images. And the morphology he was proposing, which is actually not fulfilling the basics, don't record this. So it's not fulfilling the morphological assumptions of what's an opening, for instance. But it has a very nice property of you can record this part. It has very nice property of increasing the purity of each pixel. And so if you have like fuzzy edges meaning you have material A, material B, and in the middle you have mixtures, it was kind of enhancing
the
edges.
Yeah.
So that's neat. But okay. Maybe one... let's skip this. Maybe one last question.
Mm-hmm.
The spectral range you are covering, it goes from
400 roughly
till
1,000.
1,000. Okay, yeah. So you're not covering the infrared part.
No, near infrared only. Yeah.
Okay, so if we take it from a general point of view, if we extend to the near infrared or SWIR domain, would that work?
From my point of view, it would work because here the main assumption is the distance function. Is it going to be valid again? But because so far we have considered this not only for until 1,000, but generally what are the characteristics of hyperspectral data, so then it should work for the short wave range and the rest of the range. But then of course there will be adjustments to make, like for example how do you select your reference. For example, here until 700 we have color information, so it's kind of easy to okay, my reference should be yellow. But then in the invisible, in a way our heuristic is limited, and then we also have to know about what are actually the characteristic information in that range? Is it oil? Is it water absorption or something? Then in that regard, we have to adapt how to select the reference. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, I was discussing it on Monday with one of your colleague from France, Françoise Viano. That's if you go to the thermal bands or in this direction, then the acquisition itself becomes a challenge if you want to have some well calibrated sensor.
Yeah.
And there are some troubles because to have a fully mastered acquisition condition in the visible domain, it's okay, you can have, you know, the light you want, but in the thermal domain, when you start heating the painting, the guys in the museum, they start shaking. Okay. So I will stop here. My questions. I just like to conclude by congratulating you once again for this very interesting piece of work, and this is very promising. And I'm looking really forward to seeing this in practice. We have the proof of concept. Now you have to prove it's better and easy to use.
Yeah.
I like to stress that your approach to this problem is very original, and it's not always so frequent to see really original material in the PhD, you know, there is always some incremental work with respect to the previous work and so on and so forth. But I think you there was a risk taken here starting this PhD, and you did well in taking it because you have the proof of concept. So I'm very, very happy with the outcome. So thank you so much for the discussion and congratulations once again.
Thanks.
I'm done, Mr. Chairman, President, Dean.
Yeah. Hello. Hello. Yeah. All right, sound good? Okay, very good. I'll just put this in the pocket. So I'd like to start by basically repeating much of what Jocelyn said. I very much enjoyed reading your report. Really learned a lot. I'd like to repeat this thing about your figures and this road map, kind of, to the thesis. Really enjoyed it. It really helped the reader, me, to understand, you know, where are we, where are we going.
Yeah.
So I really like that, and I would like to thank you for that. When we continue, we will have a discussion because I'm interested in your work, you know, and there will be some questions. Before we do that, I would like to start by thanking Jon Yngve and basically NTNU Gjøvik. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I really thank you. I'd like to add that, you know, in Norway and I think internationally also, this research environment that you have is very well known, very respected. I'm very impressed by what you do here, both Jon Yngve, the Color Lab, Katrin and her group, and the whole environment. So very, very good. When we move on now, my plan was to start out a little bit, maybe big picture. And then, since I'm the second opponent, I took it upon myself to have a couple of very detailed, specific questions about your thesis, some of the choices you made. So some questions about that. Then the plan was to ask some questions about maybe motivation for why you did what you did at certain stages. And then finally, to see if we can have a discussion about, you know, could you have taken other kind of trajectories, other things you could have done or could do in the future. So that's the plan, those four things. So there are, on the more big picture thing, there are maybe two things I was maybe missing a little bit when reading the thesis. Since, you know, as Jocelyn said in your discussion, your work is a little bit like theoretical. You have all these concepts and distances and so on, and you have the application in the cultural heritage paintings. You wonder a little bit about the rest of the world when it comes to hyperspectral imaging. So maybe something about transferability to other domains. You know, could you maybe have an appendix with some other kind of data just to show this proof of concept? That's the one thing. I'll let you comment on that in a second. The other thing is the Kullback Library pseudo divergence, which is very, very important to your work. And maybe when reading a thesis, it's a little bit sudden. It's like, okay, here is the Kullback Library pseudo divergence.
Right.
It's very important. We will use it from now on. I will come back to that later on, but let you start now by commenting a little bit about transferability of your work to other domains right. of hyperspectral imaging. Do you yeah. see potential? What do you think about this, your work
yeah.
in other contexts?
I think in terms of, let me go from, let's say, the theoretical side. So it like this whole framework was built on distance function, and then the distance function was different ways were considered, but in the consideration, it was made for hyperspectral image processing. So in the consideration of, let's say, the core of the framework, we didn't really have a specific domain in mind. It's really the, okay, what are hyperspectral data? They are correlated in the neighboring bands and so on. So in terms of, let's say now the core, it's transferable to other fields because the assumption of hyperspectral, as long as it's still hyperspectral image processing, then it will stay the same. Now, let's say, the application, I think, well, I should say this was kind of like one of the goal for the bigger project, that it works for the cultural heritage domain. But also briefly, a few months ago, we tried in when I was spending my time in Poitiers, we tried applying the, I don't remember exactly which one, but one of the tools that I have here to data commonly used in remote sensing. I think it was either a Salinas or Pavia dataset. So it was kind of for a short workshop showing that, okay, this framework that we have here is generic, and then we can apply it for other fields, basically. And in terms of, let's say, the technicalities in the software the toolbox, then, sorry, it's, I think it just needs a little bit more time for cleaning up and things like that. And then what we want is actually kind of to release it as a, maybe not MATLAB toolbox because it was developed in Python. So as a toolbox that, let's say you have a toolbox in MATLAB and then other people can use it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. So you see some potential that maybe yes. people outside of the field would pick up on this work and maybe use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Still on the bigger picture, Jocelyn, me and Katrin, you know, we read your report. We wrote the report, strong, weak points.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about what is your feeling? What is the strongest point of your work? What do you feel was maybe the weaker points?
Yeah, I think I would like to say the strong point of is in the rigorosity of the evaluation, because also when I was doing it, it was also the part that was, let's say, the most difficult, because well, writing the concept and so on, trying to write down my heuristic into words, into equation, it was also difficult. But something that I'm really happy about the work is really the taking the evaluation at every step. And, you know, I think one could describe it as exhausting. In terms of, okay, it was exhausting at times, but it's also exhaustive in a way that I don't leave things out when doing the evaluation. So in the end, for example, for doing this processing for the cultural heritage domain, usually what people say is, yeah, but this is the result. Yes, it looks nice, but how are you sure? How can you quantify your confidence and so on? And which is the main challenge in the cultural heritage domain. It's just one object. You don't have the ground truth for that. But at least by making sure that at each little step that we go through in the chain, we do evaluate the tools, then it's you can have a certain confidence. And with what you get, you know how to explain why it's like that.
Mm.
Yeah. And the weak point, I don't know if, but what at times I find difficult to, let's say, communicate is the fact that it's really theoretical, and then it's just that. I would also say that we struggle finding applications and finding the applications. Okay, we in here in this lab in TNU, we have acquired so many images, but we don't have conservators, for example. So we just look at the images, and because I only know the numbers and then the concepts, I'm like, yeah, that thing is interesting. That other thing is interesting, but there's no... So far, it was really difficult to find real application because we haven't really have communication with, you know, mm-hmm. the other fields. So yeah, I think, yeah.
No, I think it's very interesting to hear your own thoughts about this.
Yeah.
Maybe I could comfort you a little bit and say that this last topic you mentioned about real applications and how to, you know, justify things. You're not alone, I think, in that respect. Probably many of us have the same kind of feelings very often. I also agree that this thoroughness that you exercise in your evaluation, your metrological framework, is very... very nice, and when reading the report, you really feel that you put some thought into how to do this, you know, how to design these, you know, experiments. So I agree, it's a very strong point. On to some more specific questions. It actually related to your evaluations. Because you have very nice evaluations, you show different things, but sometimes there are some choices made. Yeah. For instance, when you add noise to your the pigments, there's a certain noise probability of 0.3.
The median filter.
No, it's with your rank order filters.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You have noise.
Yes. Yes.
And you chose how to design the noise.
Yeah.
And it's like a 0.3 noise threshold there. It's not 0.35 or 0.25. Yeah. It's 0.3. So then I just wonder a little bit what would happen in your comparisons to the other methods.
Yeah.
Your method, you think results would change with more noise, less noise compared to the others? Was there a specific reason for the amount 0.3? Of noise?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was that 0.3. I don't remember if I have other threshold for the noise, but it was well, not so much arbitrarily, but we know the limit of the median filters is at 0.5, 50%. So at the beginning, it was, let's put 10%, 0.1, and then everything works nicely because, it's not so much of a noise. But and then, you know, coming into the middle ground between the limit and then the 10%, so it was just 0.3. But it was made in a way that we know, okay, the limit is 50%. Let's go below that, but not really like smooth image 1% or 10%, something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also the choices, so the window size.
Yes.
When you have your rank order filters. So in one experiment, it's 5x5.
Yeah.
And then the next, when you come to the edges, it's 7x7.
Yeah.
Are there reasons for these choices, or more or less arbitrary?
Yeah.
What would happen if you changed very much?
Yeah. So generally, if you increase the... Because the goal of median filtering... or in a broader class is rank order, but it, like in median filtering, not the minimum or maximum filtering, is that you want to smooth the image but maintain the edges. By increasing the size of the window, then you increase, let's say, the impact of the smoothing. Let's say it will be smoothed over a larger area, but then also at the point where the size of your filter passes the size of the objects inside, the objects will start to get merged as well. So in cases where I pick the 5 or 3, something like that, I want smoothing but still kind of nicely preserve some of the little textures, things like that. But when I go bigger, then it's, I really want to stress, here is the impact, the smoothing works like this, because it's more evident when the size is bigger.
Yeah, I think my comment is more as a reader to maybe be explained these choices that were made.
Okay.
And touching a little bit upon the structuring element and the choices made there.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that? Would your results change very much from your choices to some other choices of the size?
So in terms of the size, again, I have to consider what are my goals and what are the, let's say, relevant or irrelevant sizes that I want to capture in my process. For example, in the crack detection, this one, the width of the crack, it should be something that guides you in selecting the radius or the size of your structuring element. And then the disc, basically, in the shape is basically, yes, in all the processes I've made, I only use the standard disc shape. So it's a round shape. Yeah. So just changing really the size.
Especially if the reader is not so into the field, it could maybe be good just to be explained why you know, these choices have been made made that way. Mm. Then I have a specific question on chapter 8, where you have your crack detection. You have tables 8.3 and 8.4. And it turns out that your ordering method, the CRA, combined with the Euclidean distance, performs best, it seems, as far as I could understand from those two tables.
8.3
and 8.4.
Okay.
So now I'm just looking for a comment. So why do you think this happens?
Oh, please wait a second, I have to make sense of what I wrote again. So the question was why the method...
Yeah, it's, so you argue very much for the Kullback-Leibler pseudo-divergence.
Yeah.
But if I understood those tables correctly, it was the Euclidean distance that made the best results in the end.
Yeah.
I just wonder why could this happen?
I mean, with using Euclidean distance, it doesn't necessarily give you wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
You can always use whichever distance you think is best. But here, I think, as far as I can remember, what I can argue with this why the Euclidean works best. Is that actually in this was for a real pigment patches, but artificial cracks. So I think, my argument is just that the content is really much simpler than in a real case. So, I mean, here comparing to the Kullback-Leibler, it's not so significant. It's like 189 to 193. So I mean, they are competing, but at this level of semi-artificial image, we can't really see the strength, let's say, of the KLPD. But then once you use it, for example, for the discrimination in the bidimensional or three-dimensional histogram, you start to see that it's actually giving you much better discrimination of the content I showed previously with the...
All right, very good. Then now we are closing to the end of these very specific questions, and then we will move on to a little bit higher level again.
Yeah.
So in chapter 8, you have your experiment starting from the theoretical, like designed patches, and then to the real images. And if I understood it correctly, you have controlled experiments at first. You can measure error.
Mm-hmm.
There are some optimal thresholds in your combined top hat. So now I'm wondering, maybe I misunderstood, but for the real images, when you do your thresholding, if I understood it correctly, those thresholds came from the previous experiment.
Yes.
On the...
the probabilistic crack.
Right. So how come these thresholds on these data over here could be transferred onto the real images?
Yeah.
And what can you conclude from the experiments based on those thresholds?
Initially, it was really... because for let's say for this chapter, it was not really the tools that came first, but the application that came first. So in the state of the art, there was this part of doing the thresholding. So instead of having a grayscale map of the cracks, they require a harsh binary map of the cracks. Cracks or not, cracks or not. So... in looking at the state-of-the-art procedure, we were thinking, how do we evaluate this? Because maybe, as is your concern as well, is that in the real case, it's difficult to put a threshold because things are varying, and then sometimes you have high variation, and it's just difficult to make a threshold, which is actually why we design the... the crack model at, let's say, several level. So with the binary, it's supposed to be an easy evaluation target. It's always black, and then in all places the spectrum of the crack is the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then reflecting a little bit on the real case, now here, for example, where we see it, in some places it's really dark, in some other places it's probably a bit lighter, but in any case we know that they are cracks. So that's why after the binary cracks or not, it was actually the probabilistic, so that we have kind of mimic a little bit to some extent that the cracks are not a single spectrum all over the image. So that's why with the probabilistic kind of. And then with the colors as well, because they are not only black, they are colors. But then, after having designing that, we were like, yeah, but this is a case where technically it's really easy, not like the real case, but we still need a threshold. So we took right away from the closer model of the real case and see how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And then the problem was, we applied it, we get the results, it was reasonable, and then we didn't have, because this is the real case, we didn't have the evaluation. So in a way it was for a semi-realistic case, we have that threshold, and then we applied it, and it went just until the limit of it looks reasonable.
Yeah.
So
I'm just trying to put this into the context of a very, you know, well thought through design of experiments, but then suddenly a couple of choices made that made me think, you know, okay, so some thresholds from some data just transported onto some other data.
Mm.
What does it mean? What would happen if these thresholds were changed? So just a couple of question marks that came to my mind.
And
maybe you could think about that if you know, in future work or something. And just to complete this line of thought, also in the same chapter, in figure 8.14, there was also a very arbitrary, to me at least, threshold of 14 And I didn't really understand where that threshold came from, but maybe I missed something.
Here, the threshold. Okay, so these images that I show in the 8th chapter for all the results of the remaining data for the cracks, they are using the same threshold as the last model.
Okay.
Let's say. But then also, I'll be honest in this, is that I don't really like the way that it's a harsh threshold. So probably that should be something that's to be further considered. Because when we have right after the top hat, what we have is a grayscale. And it looks nice. And then suddenly when you do thresholding, you remove a lot of things that are probably relevant at the same time as removing the irrelevant ones. So I think this is the thresholding step is one step that could be improved. I don't know, adaptive thresholding, the easiest one.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. So I'd like to probe a little bit, ask some questions on what I consider to be dimensionality reduction, in a sense.
Mm.
So you say that hyperspectral imaging offers an accuracy,
and
you don't really want to do dimensionality reduction to lose that accuracy.
Mm.
I'm not really sure what accuracy means. Is it resolution or is it accuracy in some experiment? Or
it's in terms of... So what basing that, let's say, motivation argument was that in a lot of cases, the so far as I understood, the dimensional reduction assumes that these little details are noise. But at this point, we're not sure if it's really details or if it's really something that's really small that's detected and relevant. And then in the end, because of dimensional reduction, it gets removed. But we are, so basically the argument was that, okay, we are doing this hyperspectral imaging. It's costly, it takes time, and so on. But we want to be able to perceive these little details and variation and so on.
Yeah, I see the point.
Yeah.
When it comes to the bidirectional histogram or spectral differences.
Yes.
Isn't that a dimensionality reduction in a sense?
In a sense, yes. It's so I think that comes down to the remarks of so doing a distance function to a reference. Yes, it's a reduce of information. Like you have 160 bands into one. In dimensional reduction, you probably do, let's say 160 to 5 or to 20, which is more information than what the distance give us, which is 1. But in any case, my argument would be that in computing distance to a certain reference, you capture the little details and the characteristics of this cloud, let's say, according to that reference. So yes, it's a reduction in a sense that it's projecting to that particular reference, but then you could, you know, like add more reference so that you have more information in a sense, but still in the computation, there is all the numbers, the little details are taken into account, let's say.
Okay.
Yeah.
From your histogram, the two-dimensional, where in a sense a spectra has been represented by two numbers.
Yes.
And you show these clusters.
Yeah.
Do you think one or more of these clusters could be related to your cracks, perhaps?
The cracks. Because it's also histogram. Then with the cracks like this, probably... Maybe, but a tiny cluster.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the histogram representation is that even though it's there, but it's not significant in terms of the count of the pixel, then it's probably not... what's the word? Not salient? I don't know. It's not obvious enough in when you have the bidimensional histogram. It's there, but since the cluster is really small, then probably it gets somewhere.
All right. So when you remove pixel counts, you say that you kind of remove the small cluster, like you showed us with your three-dimensional histogram. You basically took away some spectra because they weren't clustered, in a sense.
Yeah.
But wouldn't that remain some normal structures within the image then?
Yeah. So the removal of the clusters, it was actually just to show where is the mode of the cluster, like the center of the cluster.
Yeah, what would that be? Would that be a color?
This one, was it?
Yep.
Yeah. So, so basically removing this, like, by putting a threshold is basically just to visualize where the center is, because in any case you have one cloud, one blob of data, and then you just want to, let's say, go inside where is the cluster. And, I haven't done on this specific results what's really the center, but it should be one of the main colors in here.
Okay.
Yeah, but in looking at this image, it's not necessarily the cracks, because the numbers of the cracks compared to the rest of the image is maybe not significant.
So I had a feeling that you made these experiments on the histogram to show the power of the Kullback-Leiber pseudo-divergence, somehow to say that it made sense.
Yeah.
And you also said that you might in future work use that data for classification and things like that.
Mm.
And I think that could be interesting, because maybe your structures that you're interested in are not those clusters, and maybe you could then extract these small clusters you're maybe interested in.
Mm.
So let me then ask you a little bit about the Kullback-Leiber pseudo-divergence, which seems to make very much sense. I mean, I agree. It seems to be a very good thing. Could you maybe say a little bit about the motivation of this measure? Where did it come from?
Yeah.
What was the idea? Yeah. Because I think it's this intensity part that sets this aside from maybe some other measures.
First of all, just to be clear, I didn't make the measure.
Yeah.
So, but it was developed by the colleagues in Poitiers after the first article on the first four taxonomy. So at that point, we already know what we want in a distance function. So with the first proposal, we already have the desired behavior and everything that we want. It was just that the problem, the shape and intensity are merged. So in that case, it's not possible to make this, let's say, b-dimensional representation. So like chronologically, I moved on from that question, and they continued on with the criteria that was made first, and then the what are the desired behaviors and so on. But at this time, we want the two components to be separated, independent in a way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But do you think there could exist some other kind of measures out there that does the same thing in a sense, keeps track of intensity as well as shape? But it's not this Kullback-Leiber.
Yeah, there was a work from, I don't know, some years ago. It was using, it's kind of a score, let's say. It's using spectral angle as the measure for angle. And then it uses root mean square error, twice root mean square error or something, as the measure for intensity. So probably as I've briefly shown, it's the problem is that the two measures are correlated. So in the end, your discrimination is not as good as the last one. But of course, there are improvements to make, and it's still an open door. Mm-hmm. You know, like day by day. Okay, this is the most at the moment, the most suitable. We can improve more.
Yeah, the reason why I ask is that the Kullback-Leibler divergence is a part of information theoretic quantities, and there's a bunch of such quantities.
Yeah.
There are some that have like there's something called Rennie entropy, Rennie divergences, for instance, which is Kullback-Leibler is a special case of that.
Okay.
Have no idea if it would make sense in your case, but at least there could maybe be some alternatives.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, because now you have this one measure, and very much is based on that.
Yeah.
But could there be some other ways to think that could capture even know even better?
Yeah.
The representation, the intensity, the shape, and so on.
Yeah.
So that was the reason for asking. I was wondering, with Jocelyn, you touched a little bit upon the references that you use, and you're searching for these references outside of the convex hull.
Yeah.
So basically outside of the spectra you have.
Yeah.
Would that be like a false color?
Yeah.
So
in many cases it's false color.
So the concept, I mean it's probably a good idea, but just the concept of comparing things to a false color when you don't like false colors is my impression from the the other measures.
Yes, we don't like false colors as the results because it doesn't exist. But the idea of selecting the reference is like, I don't know, my illustration is probably when you are within a crowd of people and then it's difficult for you to judge what's happening. But then when you're outside this crowd, maybe like from on top of a building, then you can have a better judgment on what is happening there, because basically you are outside, so you are less biased in a way. So I think by using a false color as the reference, it's okay because it's just a point of view. But the problem with false color is something that we don't like when it's actually the results. You know, like something that represent here's the results. It's false color. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So again, to the histogram and the, you know, two-dimensional representation, could be three if you add another reference.
Yeah.
As many references as you want.
Yeah.
Could you do your ordering on that encoding of the spectra directly? You kind of vectorized your.
Yeah.
Spectre. You have a new representation.
Yeah.
Would it make sense to instead work in this new space, do you think?
Yes, but the assumption have to be rechecked in a way, because the ordering relation is based on a distance function for spectra in its original representation. So in this space, then what we have to double check, let's say, is the distance function that we use, because the depending on the relationship between the shape and intensity, is it independent, is it not, then the assumption of the distance function will change.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
But you could think, let's say, for instance, you somehow cluster your original spectra, the spectra you have, some method, into many clusters.
Yes.
Then you could think about using all those.
Yeah.
Centroids or whatever, cluster prototypes as references. Let's say you have 100 such cluster prototypes. Then you would get a 100-dimensional vector in your new representation, because you would measure the distance to each of those cluster prototypes. And I think you could maybe make this code what we call overcomplete, like sparse. So you say that a spectra is sort of only connected to a certain number of those cluster centroids.
Mm.
And maybe there are, you know, different ways to think about properties of of the spectra, distances and things like that in a new representation compared to the, you know, the, the input
the original,
data.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something to think about. And now I will touch a little bit upon a point I think Schösslin also made. So you compute these distances and you use them in your CRA, the ordering. And you need the references. And you already discussed a little bit, maybe you can automate this process and things like that. But would it be useful to not think about these references, but just basically create pairwise distances between all pairs of spectra using your Kullback-Leibler pseudo-divergence, and then work from there kind of for, let's say, to cluster these spectra, or maybe try to identify cracks or something based on the pairwise distances. Because there's a whole world of methods that take as input pairwise distances between points, like hierarchical clustering, things like that. Have you thought about this?
No.
To circumvent, not use your references at all?
Well, in a sense, then it would be another ordering approach.
Or maybe not ordering at all. Maybe clustering, classification, things like that.
So, but with the median filtering and then the morphology, then you really need to say which one is the minimum, maximum, which one is the median.
Before we touch on that point a little bit, the ordering. So, but you agree, you have a tool. To compute distances. You could also convert this into a similarity measure. By kind of an exponential function to the order of this distance. That would actually, I think, take you into the graphs that Schösslin mentioned a little bit. So let's say you, and by the way, then many, I mean, classification graphs, clustering, things like that. A door might open up. That's something you could think about. But if you have a similarity measure between, let's think of these spectra as states. Each spectra is a, we can call them a state. And let's say you can kind of jump from one state to the other with some probability. And let's say we model the probability by your distance function between two spectra. We compute the distance and then we invert this relationship so it becomes a similarity measure, like a probability. So then you have like a graph, you can jump from state to state, and you have probabilities. Your distance measures, but
inverted.
Converted into a similarity measure. I know this is not maybe your topic at all, but maybe you've heard about like ranking, things like that, on graphs. So it's what happens every time you Google something. It's a ranking, and it's based on a graph structure with probabilities to jump from a web page to another. So think about, in your case, you think you could compute this graph. There are no references at all. You don't have to select any references, but just between pairs of points, and then do some that people are doing in ranking and things like that. It's just an idea. I'm just trying to, if you think it's a good idea or not.
I'm not necessarily sure that it would work well with this distance function without reference, let's say. And then with this pairwise, I think we developed with the ordering relation specifically because we want to have less bias, such that, okay, reference is outside. So that with this pairwise, in a way, it's like you're going inside the crowd again. So you have this increased bias, but I don't know the field.
No, my point is just that maybe you could create an ordering, a ranking.
With
and then stuff it into everything you have.
Yeah.
It's just an idea.
Yeah.
If it works or not, who knows? So I'd like to just conclude a little bit. We discussed, try to start out a little bit big picture, went into some very detailed things, went back to, you know, Kullback library things and these things. Try to point out that maybe you could do things entirely different, maybe, but based on your tools still. I think it could be very interesting. Maybe something you can think about moving ahead.
Definitely, yeah.
And I very much enjoyed reading your thesis. Learned a lot. Very, very nice. So thanks for
Thank
the
you.
Discussion.
Thank you. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.